I love how different we promote men's events from women's events. Because if we were to say there's a men's event and there's going to be muffins and giggles, no one would show up. I know this will be well attended. They're actually, I'm not allowed to go to these women's events, but my wife went and she said they're fantastic. And so I would encourage you all to go. We've been on a series we're going to just continue right on through with called The Emotions of Jesus. What we're looking at is we want to learn what it means to be a full human being, to experience the emotions that God has for us and to experience and wield them well. I guess my hope would be is that as we leave this series, we would be empowered with a deeper wisdom as we understand how Jesus did it more. The God-given emotions that are given to us as humans were also given to him as a human, and he experienced them, and he emoted them. He even reacted to them, and we want to be more like him and grow in that wisdom. I was reading something not too long ago that was interesting. It was the history of America and fat and how we have felt about it and how that has led to maybe contributed or even caused the obesity epidemic. And what it came down to is that they started talking about in the 70s, there was this research coming out about just how calorically dense fat was. A spoonful of butter would be like a whole case of carrots or several bales of hay for that matter. And so it started this anti-fat craze. People were looking to pull fat out of everything. And so these companies were wanting to sell their stuff. They wanted to sell into that craze. So they began developing ways to pull fat out of all of their foods and to sell low-fat or, best of all for them, no-fat foods. What they found was there's this story about Yoplait was working on their yogurt, and tasters would come in, and they would taste the fat-free Yoplait, and they said, "This tastes terrible." Obviously, it tasted terrible. No fat in it. Fat, if you're wondering, is one of the main ways food gets flavor transferred through it. And so you pull it out, and it's like you're eating nothing. And that's what they said. It's like, might as well be cardboard, or it might as well be putty. It has no flavor. So Yoplait found that if they just upped the preserves that were in it, more berries, more sugar, people liked it again. And so what they did is they were selling low-fat yogurt that had more sugar in it than the regular full-fat yogurt. And it sold great. It sold really well. They actually began to sell more of it per person that bought it because, get this, sugar keeps you full much shorter than fat. And the reason is medical. It's something that goes on inside of you. Your body can't eat fat and immediately turn it into fat. It eats it, and it has to go into the system, be digested, and then has to convert it to sugar. The fat gets turned into sugar. The sugar goes into your bloodstream. What's not used, your body says, well, we'll keep it for later, and it stores it as fat. And so going something deep down inside keeps it to where fat keeps you full longer than sugar will. So people would eat a Yoplait that's low fat, and in an hour they wanted another one, and it was so sweet and delicious, might as well. Another thing that's dangerous about sugar over fat is that sugar makes you faster. It goes way quicker. It doesn't have to convert. It's ready to go. Its bags are unpacked. It's ready to jump in. Goes straight into your bloodstream. And then the whole process of how it doesn't keep you full for very long is because it turns into fat super quick. You didn't get to use it. And so obesity went up as people got more and more obsessed in the United States with fat-free food, fat-free this, fat-free that. It went way up. I mean, to the point to where we were, the American culture would criticize the French because they're full-fat frogois and their cream and their butter, but they're thinner than we are now. So then that was the first overreaction, and that was the article is about like these two massive overreactions to be warned about. The second one started in the 1990s. That was when the Atkins diet got really big. Just out of curiosity, who tried the Atkins diet at some point? Is it just a few of us? Oh, here, this side's with me. I did the Atkins for a while, and my oral hygienist said that was the worst era to do oral hygiene because all of that protein made the plaque on people's teeth hard as a rock. She said if a vegan comes in to have their teeth done, she doesn't have to do anything. It's just there's no protein, and that's why they die slowly. So there was this, Atkins gave birth to this idea that it's all about carbohydrates, and a sugar is a carbohydrate. And so it was all about meat's great, And actually, fat's not that bad because it keeps you full. And then people way overreacted. So it gave birth to this little baby named Atkins Diet, who grew up to be the angsty teenager of the paleo diet. Paleo diet has become something that if you were to talk to a doctor, 9 out of 10 will tell you don't do it. The paleo diet is extremely hard to do, and it's really, really pro-fat. It's all about fat. To where people eat things called fat bombs. I don't think any of us need to be a nutritionist to think that a fat bomb might not be a good thing to eat. And so what they find is that the long-term impact of the paleo diet can be more risky than others. Because what happens is that people get acclimated to all that rich, delicious fat. Like I said, fat is flavorful. So people get used to eating fat bombs and these other things, but then they start to fumble a bit. They'll have some carbohydrates on top of that. They won't eat all the vegetables they're supposed to eat. They eat way too much red meat. And before you know it, your cardiologist is having a heart attack of their own just watching your health decline. Basically, the paleo diet tells you to eat way more fat than a doctor would ever tell you to eat, and that should worry us a little bit. So they show that people that are eating this way, it's creating a whole new problem. Just because we found out that sugar and carbohydrates are a big problem, people are still overreacting. And so it seems like America bounces back and forth between this, well, is more better or is less more? And it seems that medically speaking, the answer is the right amount is just the right amount. That there is a certain amount that is the right amount, and that is what we should do, that there should be balance that's struck, not these overreacting, punish one nutrient, go to the others. Those tend to be very dangerous. It's been really the heart and soul behind a lot of how Americans have tried to address the obesity epidemic and our obsession with the fat nutrient. I say that because I think that the emotion we're going to today, and I only waited 2 weeks to go into the toughest one, anger. Anger is a bit like fat. We have these massive overreactions. We go in either way. But the reality of what we really need to think about it and to be balanced with it is a mystery that happens within. In the same way that there's a mystery of how fat and sugar become energy, there's a mystery of what happens within us with anger. That's important to know. Some people would think of anger as being a negative emotion and that it's evil and that it always leads to sin, it leads to destruction, it leads to the worst things that you've ever said to your spouse or to your kids. It leads to the way you've gotten yourself fired from work probably. It's a very dangerous emotion, and it can be, but it's not evil. Some people think of anger as being their moment of greatest clarity. And that person is all of us when we're really mad. We think, I have never thought more clearly about this issue than I do right now. Anger makes you very confident. We also think that we have to express and get it out in ways that doesn't work. Venting can be a very dangerous thing. There's a big difference between having a very open and honest conversation about how you feel about something that made you angry and talking to someone else that's just going to stir you up and make you more angry than when you first arrived. There is a balance. There must be a balance because God has been furious and yet he's never sinned. I know you're all predicting, well, Sam's probably going to read the story about the turning over of the tables in the temple. I'm not. We're going somewhere else. But in that story, Jesus got so mad that he made himself a whip. The kind of whip he made would have taken hours, like just sitting there. And then he got in there and he tore them up. I don't know if he hurt anybody, but he's flipping tables and striking whips. Had to have been kind of scary. No sin. All of that. All that destruction, all of that assault on that area, no sin. So there must be a way to be balanced about it. So Jesus then does model for us a constructive, unmarred, no aberrations anger that we can look at and understand. Aristotle said this. He said, anybody can become angry. That is easy. But to be angry with the right person and to the right degree and at the right time for the right purpose and in the right way, that is not within everybody's power and it is not easy. We want to understand how Jesus dealt with anger because the rejecting of it or the over-embracing of it leads to destruction. We're going to read a story today, but I think it's probably important to set up some historical context to what's happening. And it's in the passage before. I mean, after church today, if you want to read Mark chapter 2, you can. But I want to go over a little bit of what's happening here. What's happening is something that happens all the time. Societies in every era have wanted a very visual, easy, external measuring rod that we can hold up and to decide who's the good guy, who's the bad guy. And it's like a rubric for righteousness. It's almost like we're sinful beings that are lost and want to find righteousness again. Can you imagine such a world? But we find these things that are going to be the dividing point, and it basically it's just the empowering that we have for certain kinds of prejudice. Every era has those. I would say right now, it's probably masks and vaccines. And I know that because when I said it, you all got nervous. Because it's so controversial. It's become a huge deal. And I think even though the people that are either against or for masks and against and for vaccines, they would say that the vaccine would be the bigger thing to debate than the masks. Yet everyone seems to focus even more on the masks because it's external and you can see it and you can judge someone without even having to talk to them. It's so convenient. These external things we like to look at. For one side, those who wear masks, they're the woke, preachy sheeple who are there to make a point. For the people that are against them, those sides that aren't wearing them, they call them things like foolish. They say they're not doing their civic duty. And we've become, in a short time, many people have, I wouldn't say this is everybody, but it's become common enough that I think we're all familiar with mask rubric judgment. And I got to say, I'm actually very proud of our church because, like all public gathering areas, we've had to discuss what are we going to do, how are we going to handle it. And even though we've got a lot of opinions in this room and people of different thought, it hasn't torn us apart. There have not been these big fights and these big debates. We've been able to say that we can agree and not agree, and we still choose each other. And to me, like, man, Living Way's got good DNA. That's good church culture. But I would say, as much as that's been our church culture, let's keep pushing for that. Let's keep being a place that refuses to use the world's yardsticks and their rubrics. Jesus had a measuring rod in his time, and it was obvious, it was quick, and it was used by all of the Jews, particularly the ones that were the most preachy and difficult, and it was the keeping of the Sabbath. Sabbath was given by God for people to connect with God and to enjoy his creation. A lot of the commandments are things that, I mean, all righteousness begets good things. We should count on that. Even if it doesn't seem that way, all of the Ten Commandments would be doing good things in our lives. But the Sabbath is this loving, very kind commandment to stop and to take a break and to center with the Lord and to have your communion with God become this regular rhythm in your life. It was meant to be a blessing. And it's a very unique aspect of Jewish worship. There's a lot of things Jews did that would have been familiar to other cultures, animal sacrifice and prayer, singing songs. But Sabbath is really unique. Other cultures did not do that. It stuck out very strongly, and it always did for them. And if you think about where Jews are in Jesus' day, they've been conquered by a foreign empire. An empire that didn't want them, they just wanted the land because Israel is a wonderful crossroads between Arabia and Northern Africa. So it's full of internationals, it's full of a foreign empire, and the main thing that sets them apart and makes them different is that 6 days they work, and on the seventh day, they shut down the economy. It has become a very clear thing of this is what makes us clean and pious, pure people of Israel over the people that are stronger than us, that outnumber us, that have us hopelessly encamped around us. This was the mark of a Jew, so the Pharisees made it the measuring rod, the outward marker, because it's immediately apparent, and that's always what we like about prejudice. It's too long to ask somebody their opinion. We have prejudice about opinions, but these measuring rods tend to be something that you can get to pretty quick. And this is something you can get to quick because you can tell if someone's working on the Sabbath. They wrote so many rules about Sabbath and added to it to such a degree that it was lost completely in their rewriting of it. That which was meant to be this lifting of burdens became the most burdensome day in the month. You had a restriction on how many steps you could take when you're walking. You had to not use latches and locks. You needed to think that through ahead of time. You could not handle, there was the most basic things for survival as what you could do, and it was incredibly restricted. And the worst part of all is that all your neighbors were watching you. Like George Orwell's 1984, everybody's spying on each other to make sure that you're keeping up with this very legalistic rule. And Jesus' disciples, just before we read today, they're walking through a field on the Sabbath, which was okay. They were going to go to a synagogue on Sabbath, and they're picking heads of kernels up off of the plants, probably barley, and they're pulling it up, and then they were going like this in their hands to get the chaff off, and they were eating it, which actually in the Jewish law, there actually is a law that says you can do that as you walk along. As much as you can fit in your hand, you can eat people's grain. So they're not breaking that law, but they were accused in that moment of breaking the Sabbath. They said, well, you know what they're doing is like, this is harvesting. They're harvesting the wheat, and then they're threshing it, and they're eating it. They were accusing them of harvesting and threshing wheat on the Sabbath. And so Jesus comes back at them, and he hears out their ridiculous accusation against his disciples. And he says, didn't you hear what David did? David, when he was being pursued by Saul, went to the tabernacle and he ate the sacred bread that was only intended to be eaten by the priests, and he gave it to his men as well. Jesus' point, God cares way more about people than he does about ceremony. And that the ceremony was there to care for people, and he drives that in so clear when he says this, Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Sabbath was not meant to be a burden. It's a time for God to be with his people. It's time for him to heal their soul and their mind. It's a time for him to bring their families together. And they made it into something else. So there's our context. We understand Jesus' motives. We understand what his trip was to church. Anybody have a bad trip to church and it made you cranky when you got there? Jesus too. Mark 3. Another time, Jesus went into a synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, "Stand up in front of everyone." Jesus asked them, "Which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill?" But they remained silent. He looked around at them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts and said, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians as to how they might kill Jesus. This culture of having a shriveled hand would be a little different than ours today. We have things, ways we can get around it and jobs we could get around it. But in that time, if you were a working class subjected person of the Roman Empire and you had a hand that didn't work, you were given half wages. You would not get paid full work. They would pay you basically per hand. So you lose a hand, it doesn't matter what you're working, but whatever job you have, you are either paid half or you were reduced to begging. People dealt with the guilt of watching just the degradation and the suffering that people with disabilities had. They dealt with this guilt with this belief system, which they made up, it's not biblical, that these people with disabilities, God struck them with it, and it was judgment for some hidden sin in their life. And it was a way of protecting their own selves from feeling bad about or having to do anything, which is actually the point of last week's sermon. We conceal ourselves from compassion and keep it away from being something that's in us and comes out of us because it is something that we should act on. And it's something that can be painful to care for people who are in pain. Any state he lived in, anything that went on because of his disability, they would have said he deserved it. And we know he's deeply ashamed of his hand because Jesus had to tell him to stretch it out for anybody to see that it was healed. He had it in his cloak. He healed it, and he says, "You're going to have to stick it out for anybody to see." And so we know that he has this incredible shame. He's reduced to nothing. He's being publicly looked down every day of his life. In fact, they often would have assumed that even his parents had sinned because it was either he did or his parents did. And so his family, all these things are so much more difficult because of the shriveled hand, more difficult than we could imagine in the year that we're in. To heal him, especially publicly, by a holy prophet, would have changed this man's life dramatically. It wouldn't have just restored him back to being able to work again, to support his family, to not be either a beggar or a person living in poverty on half wages. It also would have proven to everybody that apparently God wasn't angry at him because God healed him through a prophet. I would say that it's definitely the right thing to do on Sabbath to heal this man. And it's very Sabbathy, because Sabbath is given to man to restore man for the life that they live. The Pharisees, they have this trap, though. They have this great idea, and they're going to watch him, and they know exactly what they're going to do. And he's walked right into it, and he's got no way out. He's either going to heal this man and reveal himself to be a lawbreaker by breaking the Sabbath, or he's going to refuse to heal him, and everyone will see that he's hard-hearted, and he'll begin to lose followers because why did people like Jesus more than the Pharisees? He was a much nicer guy, and he really loved him, and they could tell. Yet no trap ensnares Jesus. It's interesting, actually, to see what they wanted him to look like is they wanted him to look like a lawbreaker, and they wanted him to look like he's hard-hearted. And you read the Psalms all the time, there's stuff about, let the trap my enemies laid for me, let it fall on them. This happens here, because now they're lawbreakers for breaking the heart and of the Sabbath, and they're shown for being hard-hearted. The trap was flung back at them, and it's flung back with some attitude. Jesus is outraged over what's happening here. His outrage at the Pharisees. This healing, it's an action done in anger for two people. One, anger and indignation for this man and everybody who's like him. Jesus has been expressing throughout his ministry how frustrated he is with the Jewish leadership and how they're failing to shepherd his people. And he is frustrated, and his frustration pushes him to act and to do something for this man. His frustration is also doing it publicly and pouring out judgment on the Pharisees. Jesus is outraged at the hard-hearted natures of these leaders, that they could brutalize his people, laying burdens on them that are so heavy, and in his righteous indignation, he acts. You know, Jesus says to the people, come to me, all you who are heavy burdened, and I will give you rest. I can't help but imagine that the context of that statement must have a lot to do with Sabbath. What a burdensome day. Now, there's something interesting here is that there's actually two groups of angry people, two angry parties, as the way it normally is. Jesus is mad, and the Pharisees were mad first. Jesus is not the Messiah they wanted. He's like a king coming back from a long journey, and they are the stewards that don't want to give up the throne. This is what Jesus had to say about Jewish leadership, that they were like people that had been holding down the fort for God, and when the heir finally came, this might get really loud, but I just need to adjust this real quick, because I think it's very crickly. All right. I think we're okay. If it gets bad, I'll take the hand mic. But Jesus said that they didn't want to give him what was due to the heir. And they didn't like the way he did things. They were at a point where their hearts are so hardened that unless the Messiah showed up saying exactly what they wanted him to say and being exactly as they dreamed him to be, they were going to reject him. And their anger wants one thing. It's simple, stupid anger. They want to tear down. That is all they want to do. They don't care about the keeping of the law because they left and started plotting murder. They don't even care about being pious on the Sabbath because the Herodians were the people loyal to Herod. They were the worst of them. They want simple, stupid destruction. They want to tear down. Anger can be destructive, and it can be unguided if it has one desire, to just break something. This is the kind of anger that leads to sin. We look at Jesus, we see a very different anger, though. Jesus wants to build up. His motivation is to build up. He wants to give life. He wants to fight against those who take it. And he wants to protect people from those who attack them. Righteous anger is not about who it hates and what it wants to destroy. It is about what it wants to build up. You know, anger is a very unique emotion because it actually cannot be felt strictly by itself. Anger is an assisting emotion. It comes to the aid of others. Anger is the emotion that makes you want to act. It makes you want to do something. It's not depression that makes you want to pull away. It is something that makes you want to just attack and do something. We feel sad about something, and anger shows up on horseback with a sword and says, "Let's go. Let's start this fight right now. Who hurt your feelings?" Anger has actually very little values. It takes on the values of the emotion that just dialed 911. Whether that emotion is shame, whether it's love, whether it's jealousy, anger will show up and fight that emotion's battles for it. For the Pharisees, they felt a combination of jealousy and hate. And when anger showed up for them, what it wanted to do was to act and do something about the anger and the hate. Their anger made them set a trap. It made them disregard a human being as they used him as a prop, and it caused them to plot murder. Jesus had very different emotions that called up anger. Out of love and out of mercy and out of a sense of justice, anger came and propelled Jesus to do something. And he acted on his anger to heal and to teach and to break the plans of these law abusers. Anger, I think, is most, at least in my opinion, most definitely the most difficult emotion to wield. Especially because anger's strength is that it makes you take resolve. And anger's weakness is that it makes you take resolve on incomplete and very bad ideas. One simple way, one very clear way to grow in our anger, to use it better, is to ask one simple question when we're feeling furious. Which of my emotions just dialed 911? Anger never shows up by itself. It's never born of itself. It doesn't do its own thing. It shows up to help out another emotion. Was it love? Was it hate? Was it insecurity? Or was it confidence? Are you angry at your spouse because they forgot your anniversary? Is it possible that you're feeling hurt and vulnerable, so anger showed up with weapons to protect you? Are you angry that your kids are ungrateful for their gifts, their Christmas presents on Christmas? Is there any chance that maybe what you're feeling is shame from some ridiculous self-imposed ideal of what kind of presents you're supposed to be able to afford your kids? Anger doesn't come alone. It comes to assist others. I have this certain little window, a little pocket of my life where I can become so unbelievably irrationally angry. And you know when it happens? It's when I'm doing something with like actual material things and they don't work. It started when I was a kid. I would get Legos and I'd get the instructions and I'd screw a step up like seven steps back and I could have committed murder. I'm getting, you know, you get a new computer, you're setting it up, and one piece of software won't load, no matter what you do. That thing is this close to getting thrown out a window. I got a 3D printer, and those take a long time to set up. Like, they come from China, and China's like, good luck, figure it out. And so I wanted to do just one simple modification, and it took, like, just, like, I think, honestly, 4 months of troubleshooting with the manufacturer. And I was losing it. I'd have to take 3D printer breaks where I was like, this hobby that's supposed to make me happy is making me furious. And I had to really think about it. And you know, honestly, it still makes me mad when that stuff happens. But deep down, I prayed about it, and this took a long time because sometimes, man, your anger trigger, it's deep. I prayed about it. What I felt is that I had this deep-held belief that I'm just simply not good enough for things to work for me like they work for other people. And that could be anything. I mean, that insecurity played a role into being a lead pastor here. Like, well, it usually goes well, but I am Sam Albrecht, so what's going to happen? It is hidden deep. But you know what? The sanctification of Jesus takes place really, really deep. Up high, where things could be easily discernible and we can figure out an emotion very quickly, and where it goes very, very deep. Dealing with anger, excuse me, every time when it comes up is really important. This is part of the other overreaction, that we can just go Luke Skywalker and meditate it away. Buried anger actually never dies. It gets buried alive, and then it comes back. Sometimes still as anger, and sometimes as something else. In fact, conventional wisdom says that most undiscernible depression, like just the depression that hits and we don't know why, is more often than not frozen anger. And a person who refused to confront and refused to assert themselves in abusive situations or refused to say to someone, that hurt my feelings, that made me angry, as they bury that and they bury it and they bury it, it never actually dies. It was buried alive and became depression. And did you know that all overreactions are a reaction to the past? Every overreaction we do, we are reacting to the past from unresolved anger. People who are globally angry all the time, they're not just born with a greater temper. These are people who chose at one point in their life to not be angry when they should have been, to not assert themselves when they should have. If someone's screaming in their car because they've been cut off, you can bet that it's not the car cutting them off that made them that mad. Who knows what it was? Maybe they grew up in a family where they had a sibling that always stepped all over them and always got their way, and they never felt like they got their justice. So when that happens, boy, does it hit the button, and the anger comes spewing out. A good thing to always ponder is, well, that was an overreaction. What did that remind me of? If we want to be better with our anger, we're going to have to deal with stuff that we have buried and put away. Life is incredibly unjust. You've got a plethora of angry stimuli. And some people here need to unpack that buried anger. I did this recently. Went through a series, Elena and I did, and there was this chapter this week where it was going through, like, unpacked anger. And I felt like you could have gone to me and gone, is there anger in here? Whoa! Just, wow, I guess I'm super mad about that still. Because I'm a barrier. I bury stuff, and I'm working on it, and I think I have gotten better, but burying is incredibly destructive, and it can be a tough week, but it leads to a really great month after that, and then a great month after that, and a habit of confronting things as they come along. It makes a big difference. Taking responsibility for things, thinking back to things that make us angry, we realize that we were the one at fault, and our anger was just coming to the battle cry of guilt coming to fight for us. And also times that we needed to assert ourselves a bit more, to not let things happen, and that our anger was trying to come to the aid of injustice. This is annoying me so much. I want that hand mic. Can I get it? Jason, do you have it? We're good. Is anybody else getting annoyed by that? Is it just me? I would hope that this sermon is so good that you don't care about the static. Yeah, this thing should work. All right. Ooh, and I'm deeper. The guiding principle, though, whether it comes to the moment or going deep, it remains very similar. It is a matter of why am I experiencing anger? What is going on inside of me? To which emotion, to which feeling did anger come and answer the call? Anybody can become angry, Aristotle said. That is easy. But to be angry with the right person, and to the right degree, and at the right time, and for the right purpose, and in the right way, that is not within everybody's power, and it is not easy. We want to ask God to be coming and doing his work within us. Both the things that we've buried so far from the past and the day-to-day anger that comes up to us, to be people who have wisdom to discern quickly, are we being a Pharisee or are we being a Jesus? Are we acting on anger based on things that we should not be acting on?
their hatred, their jealousy? Or are we feeling angry over things that matter, like justice and compassion and mercy? Anger is not an evil emotion. It has no opinions. It shows up and fights for the opinions of something else. So we should ask God, God, deep within me, do the work that I could grow as a person to discern my anger more clearly, to unpack the anger from my own past, that I could be a person who can flow and let this emotion motivate me and be more human and be more like Jesus. Let's pray. Lord, right now, we just open ourselves up to you in our mind and in our spirit. We ask that you would just, would you minister, God? Would you come and would you give wisdom? Lord, I pray that you would remind us. We're praying right now for the next day. We're praying for the Mondays and the Tuesdays and the Wednesdays when anger comes to us, that you would help us break the habit we've had to be thoughtless with it, but that we would be thoughtful with the Holy Spirit, that your presence would be with us, and we'd remember. We would remember in the moment. Why am I angry? What was I feeling that anger came to help me with? Lord, I pray that you would give us humility to repent when we find it came for a wrong reason, and that you would give us courage to act when it came for a good reason. Lord, I lift up right now all the people in here that are thinking that it's time to think back of, why are they so angry all the time? Why does it seem like they can just be pushed into rage so quickly? Lord, as you bring healing to them, to their beliefs and to their spirit, to their soul, God, I pray that it would be the amazing sanctification of the Holy Spirit, that as you heal them, the healing would sink even into the past, into the things they used to think, that it would drift into the future and affect who they are becoming. Lord, I pray for the tough moments of letting out the dangerous emotions that we locked away. Lord, would you help us process those alongside your Spirit? Knowing that you keep us safe in the process, that there is a goal on the other side of such a difficult crucible as that. Lord, I pray that in those moments that we would feel relief from depression. We would feel relief from that global anger that is around us all the time. Father, conform us to the image of your Son, that we could wield all of our emotions as he did, acting on them as he did, wise as he is wise. Let us control our anger, to use it, to acknowledge it, and to be fully human. In Jesus' name, amen.